And I can tell that he speaks from the heart, and I got a lot out of the guy. And also, we're both big fellas, so we kind of got along pretty good instantly. And so I give you Jack C.
This is one large church basement, I'll tell you that. My name is Jack, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank Robert and the committee for inviting me. I guess, to be more accurate, I want to thank Robert and the committee for allowing Chet to invite me. I think it's important that you know that Chet is the one who's responsible for inviting me. Because if in the course of the next 2.5 hours I say anything that upsets you, you talk to Chet about that, because that's his responsibility. I am a member of the cleverly named Hagerstown group of Alcoholics Anonymous. If we knew it was going to be important, we'd have probably called ourselves the Slippery Slopes or something like that. But the Hagerstown group is the third oldest group in Maryland. And in order to make sure that I tell you the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, they have sent two lie detectors down here from our home group, Sam and Mike. Where are you guys? Oh, you're over there. Okay, stand up, Sam. I want them all to see you. I understand there's a 13-step dance to follow this lead, and I hope you all got a good look at Sam. Forget about Mike. I got here Thursday, and I was here Thursday night, and for all the speakers yesterday and today, and I have heard Matt stand at this podium at each meeting, hold up what looked like a cell phone and asked you to please turn your cell phones off or put them on vibrate. And at every meeting, I've heard at least one, if not more, cell phones go off. Now, I know that we are many and varied, and there are some common threads that run through our lives, and I don't like being told what to do any more than you do. So, if you're here this evening, and you have a cell phone with you, please, by all means, turn it on. If you are expecting a liver transplant. Otherwise, please, as Matt requested, put it on vibrate, and that way you can enjoy your incoming call and you will not disturb the rest of us. I got a call tonight at 6 o'clock from one of my sponsees, Robert. And, of course, Robert never pays a lot of attention, and he thought I was in Hagerstown. And I said, "No, Robert, I'm not. I'm in Atlanta." He said, "Oh." He said, "How many people are going to be there?" And I said, "Well, when Chet invited me, he said there were going to be 5,000 people. And I don't know how they're going to get them all in that room, but I'm sure they will." Now, Robert also asked, and Charlie, you need to get me an extra tape of this. He asked if I would bring him a tape of this lead. I don't know what Robert's going to do with that tape, because he doesn't listen to me when I'm sitting right across the table. But I think it's important that he knows there's 5,000 of you here to hear it. So I thank you all for that. Now, if you were here Thursday night, or yesterday, or today, You have heard the good speakers up to now. It stops here. Tomorrow is another day. Come back. Carl will do a great job, I know. But I'm just here to tell you, our book says in a general way, what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. Usually it functions like this. Alcoholics are asked to speak on Saturday night. My mom's 92 years old, and I spoke with her today at lunchtime. And every time I tell her that I've been invited to speak at one of these occasions, she is mystified. My mom was married to my alcoholic father for 30 years. She knows what an alcoholic is. And when you Al-Anons build that Al-Anon Hall of Fame down there in Virginia Beach, my mom is going to be in the untreated wing. My mom knows what an alcoholic is. She tells me my father was an alcoholic. I am not an alcoholic. And I think it's about time I started listening to my mom. I'm going to put my watch up here. As somebody said earlier, I really can't see it and I don't pay any attention to it, but I think it gives hope to the newcomer, and so we'll put it up there. Another reason that my mom is confused about me being an alcoholic, and I must say it gives me some pause. And I tell you this, not because I'm proud of it, but it's just a fact. It's my story. We're many and varied. I haven't been to prison. I haven't been to jail. I've never been arrested. My wife and I, if I don't screw this thing up, in August, we'll be married 40 years. After you hear this talk, you're probably going to want to give her a chip for that, at least. I don't have any children out of wedlock. We have three wonderful kids. None of them are in this fellowship. I don't know that any of them are qualified to be in this fellowship. I've never been fired from a job because of drinking. I've never gotten a DWI, a DUI, a driving while intoxicated. Nothing like that. I don't even have a good tattoo. And it's my understanding one or more of all of those things are worth a great deal here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I come here devoid of that. If I'd have known it was going to be that important, I assure you I would have tried harder. But some of you I know are probably sitting there saying, what is this guy doing here? Did Chet lose his mind inviting him? And so let's see if we can identify a few things in my experience that would qualify me for membership in this fellowship and to be behind this podium this evening. In a general way, what was I like? Well, I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief, a user, abuser, people, places, and things, and I tended to be overserved from time to time. And I think, Carol, you need to know I'm going to start picking up speed here because I got a two-hour talk to put in 60 minutes, and I know you can do this. I wish all of you could be down front. She has got the greatest facial expressions. It's just marvelous. I knew I was in Georgia when I got here on Thursday night. She had her shoes off while she was doing this. I thought, that's great. Chet said all I had to have on was a coat and tie. He didn't say anything about shoes. I knew I was in Georgia. You need to know, before I get started, my mom, as I said, my mom was married to my alcoholic dad for 30 years. Now, here's something that happened in my life before I started drinking. I was home with my dad, and my mom and my sister, younger sister, were out. My dad and I were having a discussion about something he wanted me to do, which I didn't want to do, and we started that negotiating kind of thing, and finally he said, "Son, why don't you tell me what you want me to do? I'll do anything you want me to do. What is it you would like me to do?" And I said, "I'll make that deal. I want you to stop drinking." "Well," he said, "stop drinking, huh? Well, you're probably right. Your mom's been after me to stop drinking, and I know we're having a lot of trouble down at the store, and I think my drinking has something to do with that, and we're behind in the payments on the house, and okay, son, we got a deal. I'll stop drinking." I got to tell you, that was the happiest day of my life as a 14-year-old boy. I knew that there was a God. I had been praying to God that my father would stop drinking. I knew my mom had been praying that he would stop drinking. I know my sister had been praying that he would stop drinking. I knew that there was a God. This was an answer to prayer. When my mom and my sister got home that night, I met them at the door and I told them, "Our problems are solved. Dad and I have had a discussion and he has agreed to stop drinking." And joy reigned supreme in our house that night. And the next day he got drunk. And it wasn't funny. Not to this 14-year-old boy. What kind of God would play that kind of hoax on a child like me? Oh, I believe there was a God. But what was wrong with my prayer? What was wrong with me that God would not respect my prayer? What was wrong with me? What was inadequate about me that he would play such a cruel joke on my sister and my mom and me? Well, that was the day I shut the door on God. Now, I got to tell you, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was really surprised to read in our book that at an early age, many of us had closed the door on God. And I thought I was the only one. But I knew that if I was ever going to do anything in this life, if I was ever going to have any success, then I was going to have to do it on my own. And I sure wasn't going to ask God for any help. As a matter of fact, I didn't want to have anything to do with the God of my understanding. And so I set out to make something in this world. Well, it wasn't too long after that I was introduced to alcohol. And it did for me what I suspect it did for everyone in this room who's alcoholic. I mean, where had this been? I could have used this in kindergarten. You know, Beth's husband says he could have used it in kindergarten. You know, eat the cookies, drink the milk, take the nap. Give me a drink. You know, I could do things drinking that I could never do not drinking. It just seemed to make me complete. Indeed, I seemed to fit in. It seemed as if, you know, I could do these things like dance, you know, talk to girls. I thought I could sing. I heard a lady at a podium one time say that her pimples fell off and her boobs got big. Well, I experienced the pimples falling off part, not the others. But, by the way, Matt, when I was at all these other meetings I've been to, and you were talking about the taper, and there was something that you could buy, he was selling something back there. I don't know what you said, I know what I heard. And he's selling something different tonight. I'd take one, please. I could do things drinking that I could never have done. And as Beth said on Thursday night, I felt sorry for my dad that he had such a hard time with alcohol. You know, but hey, I could control my drinking. I was the guy who drove everybody home at the end of the party. Alcohol became the most important thing in my life. When you're 15, 16 years old, it's not readily available. And so it was like, who's going to get it, where we're going to get it, where we're going to meet, how much we're going to meet or get when we meet, and who's got, where we're going to have enough, and where we're going to put it, and who's going to bring the backup stuff. And there was a lot of planning going on with that. And I drank as much as I could, as often as I could, whenever I could. And I loved it. Loved everything about it. I was getting ready to go to California with a friend of mine. We had 12 cases of beer in my car and an overnight bag. We had everything you need for a trip to California. And his father said he couldn't go. And I was crushed. But with a car full of beer and a pocket full of money, I went to Ocean City, Maryland, a little resort right along the Atlantic Ocean where people go in the summertime. And I had friends working there, and they gave me places to stay for free, and I ate leftover restaurant food at the, you know, go by at the end of the day and pick up half a lobster tail that somebody didn't eat or a crab cake. And all I had to worry about was drinking. And I had a great time. And I'm a keen observer of the social scene around me. And one thing I noticed in Ocean City, well, one, I wanted to work in Ocean City. Wanted to work there. But if you're a beach boy or a bus boy or a clerk or a waiter or a waitress, bartender, it didn't make any difference. If you drank like I drank and acted like I acted, they would arrest you in Ocean City. But I did notice there was one group of people who were not getting arrested, and that was the police. So, I became an Ocean City policeman. First year I was there, they gave me a beat patrol. I walked the boardwalk. I was assigned a post very close to the most popular bar on the walk. I had only been there a week or 10 days when it became apparent that I possess an innate ability to spot underage drinkers. I would spot an underage drinker. I would approach him or her. We would have a discussion. We would establish that they were indeed underage. I would look in the cooler. There may be Cokes and tuna fish on top, but if you reach all the way down to the bottom, there's always going to be Budweiser down there. And then the discussion would begin. Your life, as you've known it, has just ended because you're going to jail. And you're not going to college. And if you're thinking about the military, you're not going there either. And you're going to have to call your mom or your dad back in Baltimore or wherever you're from. And you're going to have to tell them, come down here to the jail and get you out. You want to suggest an alternative? What did you want to suggest? Confiscate the beer. That's worthy of discussion. You do understand that if I take the beer, I got to take the cooler and the tuna fish. I can have the cooler? Okay. It's really tough walking a beat dragging a cooler around behind you. So I had to work out a deal with my lieutenant and sergeant. They would come with their squad car, and they would take the beer, and they'd give it to me in the cooler, and they'd give it to me at the end of the night, so long as I gave them the whiskey. And that seemed to be fair, because I wasn't drinking whiskey then. I didn't get arrested that summer, so I went back for another summer. The second summer, they gave me a squad car. You can do a lot more with a squad car, believe me. Got lights, siren, the whole thing, man, and a big trunk. You can do a lot with a squad car. I had such a good time that year, I went back for a third summer. And I'm going to tell you about an event that occurred which changed the direction of my life. I'm a college kid, and like a lot of college kids, I haven't got a clue as to what I want to do. You know, I'm just showing up, working on getting that 2-point average. I'm driving down the beach highway at 3 a.m. I see a car, a convertible, obviously drunk driver. I pulled the car over. The guy is just drunk as a lord. I'm writing him up his ticket, and he says to me, he says, "You don't know who I am, do you?" I said, "No, I don't." He said, "I am the state's attorney for Worcester County, the county you're standing in right now." I didn't know what a state's attorney was. So I said, "Good for you." Signed the ticket. He signed the ticket. There was a sober guy in the car. I let him drive off, and I went about my business. 8 o'clock in the morning, I pull into the parking lot at City Hall there for the police department. And there, standing in the parking lot, is the chief of police. And he says to me, "Quarterman, come up to my office and bring that uniform citation book with you." Now, these were the first words the chief had spoken to me all summer. I thought this was a good thing. I'm going to get recognition, long overdue recognition, I thought, for a job well done. So I go up to his office, and I walk in there. There on the couch, right inside the door, is the guy I gave the ticket to at 3 o'clock in the morning. And the chief said, "Give me that book." And I gave him the book, and he flipped it open. He handed it to the guy on the couch. The guy takes out a pen, and he writes across the face of that ticket, "Case dismissed." It was at that moment that I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. And if I could become one of those state's attorneys, by golly, I wanted to be a state's attorney. Because the ability to dismiss criminal charges with a stroke of a pen, if you drank and drove like I drank and drove, that was going to come in mighty handy. So I went to law school. Now, I should tell you that I met my wife while at the University of Maryland. She was a member of the sorority, which was right across the street from the fraternity that I had joined. I'd like to tell you that it was an academic fraternity that I had joined, but it was not. And my wife, we went to a social event hosted by the fraternity, and I took her home at the end of that night, and she was the first woman I had dated in college who did not throw up in my car. I said, "I could marry this woman." And I did. And she and I had a lot of fun drinking until she started having children. And then she stopped drinking. What's that all about? Go figure. Anyhow, I get out of law school. I was born and raised in Hagerstown. My wife and I moved back to Hagerstown. Lo and behold, what do you think? The state's attorney's office has a position for an assistant state's attorney. I go right over there. "Here I am, answer to your prayers, sign me up." And this is what I heard him say. Keep in mind, I have a problem hearing correctly. But I think I heard him say, "What? You some kind of idiot? You've never tried a case. You just graduated from law school. You've never interviewed a witness. We don't have time to train you. Get out of our office." That's what I thought I heard him say. Upon reflection in Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe the truth is they said the position has been filled. However, I heard what I heard, and I had a resentment over that. I didn't know that until I got to AA. I just thought I was angry. Turns out I had a resentment. I don't know about where you're from, but where I'm from, they elect the state's attorney. So I went out and found somebody who wanted to be state's attorney. I ran his campaign for state's attorney. He got elected state's attorney, and he made me deputy state's attorney. We had a problem in the state's attorney's office. We didn't have any badges. No point in being a state's attorney if you can't have a badge. So I designed a beautiful badge, wonderful badge. And when you get a badge, they give you a badge case. And in that badge case, there's a little glassine place where you put your driver's license. So when you get stopped by the police and they ask to see that driver's license and registration, you open up that thing and you show it to them. And there's the badge and there's the driver's license. They don't care about the driver's license. What badge is that? Oh, the badge officer? Deputy State's Attorney, Washington County. "That's perfectly all right, officer. I understand. Just doing your job." No, I'll be careful on the way home. I appreciate the professional courtesy. Thank you so much." Now, you may be getting an idea why I haven't been arrested. But it gets better. My boss, the state's attorney, was to be appointed judge. But I don't know how it is in your local government. In our government, our state senator stuck his nose in where it didn't belong. He screwed the whole thing up, and somebody else got appointed judge. Now, if he had got, my boss had been appointed judge, I'd have been appointed state's attorney. So I was some kind of upset about this. Not because of my friend not getting the judge job, but because I didn't get the state's attorney's job. I was sitting around with some friends of mine who drank like I drink, and we were discussing the injustice of it all. We said, somebody has to run for the state senate. So I ran for the state senate. I didn't know the state senator was going to run off with the secretary from the Appropriations Committee and abandon his wife and children, but he did. And I got elected state senator. I don't know how it is where you are, but where I am from in Maryland, when you get elected state senator, they give you a license plate that says state senator. Now, this is an aid in effective law enforcement, because when they come up behind you on the interstate and they got those overheads going and they get close enough to see that license plate, they turn off those overhead lights, they come up alongside of you, they turn on the dome light, they beep the horn, and they wave, "Hi, Senator." "Hi, Officer." "Hold it down, Senator." "No problem, Officer." I'd like to tell you about my legislative experience in our state capital, Annapolis. But in our state capital, very much like your state capital, I am sure, we have a group of people whose sole responsibility is to see to it that every elected representative, be they member of the House or Senate, is provided with alcohol at any time of the day or night when they're thirsty. These people are called lobbyists. I had a number of lobbyist friends, and so anything I might tell you about my legislative experience would be hearsay, and I don't want to spread rumors here before you this evening. However, my friend, the state's attorney, well, he still wanted to be judge, and the guy that got appointed judge, he didn't like being judge, and so he quit. And I went to the governor and I said, "Governor, I'd like you to appoint my friend, the state's attorney, circuit court judge." The governor was still smarting over that little bad publicity from that dust-up several years before. And he said, "I'm not going to appoint your guy because I'm still upset about all that negative publicity." He said, "But I'll tell you what, if you'd like to be circuit court judge, I'll appoint you." Well, it's a 15-year position, and it only comes around every now and then. We only have two of them in Hagerstown, so I said, "Okay." So I became a circuit court judge. Now, keep in mind that all through this, I'm drinking alcoholically. Here's an example of what I was doing. The Bar Association was having a continuing legal education program on the prosecution and defense of drunk driving cases. Prosecution's going to put on all the stuff that they do. Defense was going to put on what stuff they do. And they needed a volunteer to take the breathalyzer. Somebody who was impartial, unbiased, fair-minded, and willing to drink the beer. So they brought out, I had a breathalyzer. They brought out a tray. I had six cans of beer all iced down. I said, "What's that?" They said, that's the beer for tonight's program. I said, "You do realize that this is a two-hour program? We're going to need more beer." He said, "We got plenty in the back." I said, "Ice it up and bring it out. I'm not drinking any warm beer." So they did, and the deal was that, they start the program, and I start drinking the beer, and then every 15 minutes, I'd blow into the breathalyzer, and of course, you do a test at the beginning, and it's .00, and so, okay, here we go. And so 15 minutes into the thing, it's like .08, and then .11, and then .15, and then .19, and then .23, and 0.26 and 0.28 and 0.32. And at that point, they called upon me to put on my part of the program, which which I'm told was pretty good under the circumstances. And at the end of it all, Sergeant Long was packing up his breathalyzer, and I said to the guy who was chairman, I said, "Who's going to drive me home?" He says, "Well, we didn't think about that." And I said, "Well, I just blew a .32 in Sergeant Long's breathalyzer. I can't go out and get in my car." I said, "Tell you what, I'll go into the bar. You just let me know when Sergeant Long's gone." And I went into the bar, and I had a couple of drinks, and then I left there and went down to the Broad Axe. I had a couple of drinks down there, and then I went over to the cellar door and had a couple of drinks, and then I went home. And that's just an ordinary night of drinking for the judge. And one night, a lawyer and I were going out to dinner, and well, the real purpose wasn't dinner, it was just a drink. And we did a lot of drinking, and we ended up in a local establishment, which was, well, it was well known to be the destination of choice for all the single, divorced, and recently separated women in our county. My friend and I just went there to get a nightcap, and had I known that that nightcap was going to be my last drink, and that I was going to have to come here to the Georgia prepaid convention and stand before you and acknowledge my last drink, I can assure you that I would have ordered something else. I had a love affair with Jack Daniel's Black Label on crushed ice with a twist. Oh, to die for. Wonderful. I was very fond also of the gin martini. But I do have to tell you that I had a really bad gin experience. And it's even hard for me today to go into a pine forest. I liked everything about drinking. I liked the appropriate drink in the appropriate glass. I liked the long stemware. I liked the little short glasses. I liked the tall, thin Tom Collins glasses. I loved it all. If you handed me a paper bag, however, and said, "This is good, take a pull on this," I would take a pull on this. "Oh, boy, that's good stuff. What is that?" "Don't worry, just drink it." "Oh, man, good." You know how you all have a party, have people over one night, and the next morning you're out there kind of cleaning up, and you go by picking up the beer cans. Here's one that's half full, you know. "What was that?" "Cigarette butt." I kind of thought there were some cigarette butt drinkers in here. I loved it. Loved everything about it. So I'm embarrassed and ashamed to tell you that my last drink of beverage alcohol was Tia Maria. I know. Pretty weenie drink, isn't it? Certainly wasn't my intention to be the last. I can, however, tell you this. I know I got that last drink out of a tainted bottle, because on the way home, I threw up. And that's not something that I do. So obviously, that bottle, there was something wrong with it. Next morning, I got up to go to work, and my wife is an elementary school teacher. Elementary school teachers bring every germ in the county home from their schools. I got up that morning. Out of nowhere, I have flu. Imagine that, flu. Well, I went to work, because we go to work if we can. I went to work, got home that night. Next day was Good Friday, so the courthouse was closed, so I still got the flu, and now I've got that upset stomach that comes with flu. Saturday I wasn't feeling much better, but by that time I developed that lower tract distress. This is a bad combination, as some of you know. Because when you got that lower tract distress and that upset stomach, you don't know whether you're supposed to sit or kneel or kneel or sit. And it'll hone your decision-making round to a fine edge. And all I can say is my wife would tell you that on at least one occasion I made the wrong decision. However, you'll have to talk to her about that. By Monday, I was pretty dehydrated. They put me in the hospital. Monday night, my abdomen was distended. They performed a laparotomy on me, opened me up. Found that my abdomen was full of peritonitis, gangrene. While they were in there trying to clean that up, my kidneys quit. My liver was enlarged. My pancreas was digesting itself. And my respiratory system quit. So things weren't looking too good for the home team. I was in intensive care in Hagerstown for 3 weeks. We are a small town. We got a small newspaper. I was the youngest trial judge in the state. So when that happens, judge goes to hospital. Judge has flu. Judge condition worsens. Judge placed on critical list. I'm becoming a public relations nightmare for the hospital because I'm dying and they don't know what to do. So they told my wife, they told me that they were going to send me to Johns Hopkins Hospital. This sounded like a good thing to me, because I knew people that had gone to Johns Hopkins Hospital, and they came home. And I knew people had gone to the Washington County Hospital, and they died. So I was okay with that. Now, they told my wife they were sending me to die, because there was nothing else that could be done for me. I'm glad they didn't tell me that, because I would have found that discouraging. So I got down to Johns Hopkins, and for 2 weeks they did everything but hang me by my thumbs, and I just couldn't take it anymore. Now, my respiratory system had returned, but my kidneys weren't functioning, my liver was still enlarged, and my pancreas was still digesting itself. And on May the 13th, they came into my room, and before they could say anything, I said, "Hey, guys, you know, tomorrow's my birthday, and I can't take this anymore. You've got to give me a day of rest. You've got to give me a day of rest." And they said, "Well, the reason we're here, Judge, is because we don't know what to do for you. We've done everything that we know to do. And so, that's why we're here. We're not going to do anything tomorrow. And so you get your day of rest." Well, May 28th, two weeks later, I walked out of the Johns Hopkins Hospital. They never diagnosed what was wrong with me. Now, personally, I think it's a lot better to survive an undiagnosed illness than to die of a known cause. So it wasn't a big point with me. But when you're in a hospital for 7 weeks like that, they like to talk to you before they send you home because they want to tell you what to do or what not to do. But since they didn't know what I had, they didn't know what to tell me other than, "Don't get it again, it's likely to kill you." So now I'm just getting ready to thank very short meeting with these doctors, and they said, "Whoa, wait, got one more question, Judge." "What's that?" "Do you drink?" "I beg your pardon?" "Do you drink?" "Well, I'm a lawyer. I had to drink with clients. I had to drink with other lawyers. Now I'm a judge. I have to drink with other judges. I have to drink with lawyers. Of course I drink." "How much do you drink?" "Not too much." "Why do you ask?" "Well, alcohol really does a number on people. And in your case, your kidney functions returned. And alcohol is really destructive on kidneys. And your function's back, and your liver's doing pretty good, too. Your enzyme levels are coming back. It seems to be recovering without any permanent damage. And you know what alcohol does for your liver, or to your liver? And then, of course, there's your pancreas, which stopped digesting itself. And alcohol does a real number on your pancreas. And we just think you ought to give these vital organs a little opportunity to recover." I said, "Well, what are you suggesting?" He said, "Well, we don't want you to drink for a year." "Yeah, I know." But they were pretty serious, and I wasn't going to get out of that hospital unless something happened. So I said, "Well, I had my last drink on April the 7th, and this is May 28th. I could probably do that till next April 7th. And they said, no, Judge. This is Labor Day. This is Memorial Day weekend, and we want you to not drink from June the 1st. Now, I know that there are people in this room already who have identified the injustice that these doctors were trying to foist upon me. I was getting no credit for my 7 weeks of sobriety. I didn't know that that was alcoholic thinking at the time, but I do know it's now, because when I talk to, like, normal people, they don't laugh at that. They look at me like I'm crazy. And, of course, you know I am crazy. That's why I was invited here tonight, because I'm crazy. Which ought to call into question your sanity, because you're in here listening to me. So, I got out of the hospital on May 28th, and I began the absolute worst experience of my entire life. I began the not drinking and not changing phase of my life. Now, if you're here tonight, and you're doing the not drinking and not changing thing, please stop. Please. Because as one of our speakers have already said, suicide will become a very viable option in a very short period of time. Not drinking and not changing for alcoholics is a death sentence. It's a death sentence. I hear some people say, don't drink and go to meetings. I think that's a death sentence. People hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer and expect something to rub off. What rubs off is death. Because for people like me, I drink no matter what. I don't know how to live not drinking. Drinking is the solution to my problem. And when you take my solution away, I live in the insanity of my mind. Restless, irritable, and discontent? Quite an understatement in my case. My wife and I, we've been separated 6 times. 3 times while I was drinking, and there were women involved. And 3 times while not drinking, and there were women involved. I think it's pretty clear alcohol had nothing to do with those 6 separations. But alcoholism had everything to do with those 6 separations, because nothing was changing except I wasn't drinking. Like I say, we have 3 wonderful children. The insanity of living in an alcoholic home with a drinking alcoholic is pretty bad. I'll grant you that. I'm not so sure that living in an alcoholic home with an untreated alcoholic isn't worse. I have no idea how much damage I did to those children and to my wife. But I know that it was an insane way to live for me, and I was in tremendous pain. Not physical pain, but emotional pain. I had no idea how to quiet the voices in my head. No idea how to do that. And you know how it is when they start talking. And they start voting on stuff. I don't get a vote. I just got to go do what they say go do, because maybe this will fix it. Maybe this will make it better. You know, so I was married, okay, and I had a primary girlfriend. And I had a backup girlfriend just in case the primary found out who I really was. And I had another girlfriend for special occasions. And I was managing all of that. Now, if you're looking for an example of a delusional thought, you just heard one. Our book says we're driven by 100 forms of self-delusion, not just 1 or 2, 100 forms of self-delusion. I'm dying of untreated alcoholism, and I don't know it. I got 2 really good friends, Ken and Bob, and both of them were members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I should tell you that my alcoholic dad, on July the 3rd, 1968, walked by the Methodist Church in Hagerstown, and the pastor put out on the board, "Don't buy a 5th on the 3rd for the 4th. My dad went to AA that night, never to drink again. He had 15 years of continuous sobriety in this wonderful program. And for that, if nothing else, for that, I owe Alcoholics Anonymous a tremendous debt of gratitude. Thank you so much for my father's life." Everything my father held most dear was restored to him. You know, his self-esteem, his sense of well-being, his value as a man. You know, when he was drinking, my sister got married, and he wasn't invited to the wedding, and I gave her away because she was afraid he'd show up drunk, and he did show up drunk. But when he died with 15 years of continuous sobriety in this program, he had made his amends, and he had done what he is called upon to do, and his life had been transformed. But I'm dying of untreated alcoholism, and Ken and Bob saw that. One day Bob came to me and said, you know, Jack, I didn't know your dad, but I know he was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was wondering if you have any interest in reading this book called Alcoholics Anonymous, you'd find out maybe something about your dad's disease. Clever guy, that Bob. I think we all know if he'd have come to me and said, do you think you ought to read this book so you could find out what's wrong with you? Well, hey, there's nothing wrong with me. I am not drinking. Therefore, not alcoholic. I think we can all agree. Alcoholics drink. I'm not drinking. Therefore, non-alcoholic. Okay. Well, all right, I wouldn't mind. I'd like to learn a little bit about my dad's disease. I'd like to know about some of the stuff that was going on that made the things happen in our lives that happened. And so I read the big book, and I was not surprised to read in that book that my dad's in there. No question about that. He's in there. He was a real alcoholic. He deserves to be in that book. His behaviors, the way he lived his life, it's in there. And I expected to find it in there. However, I did not expect to find me in there. Already mentioned that thing about many of us closed the door on God at an early age. Well, I used to go over to the Broad Axe, my favorite watering hole, with fully intending not to drink tonight. I told her I'd be home at 6 o'clock, have dinner with the kids. That's what I'm doing. Not drinking tonight. Well, you got a pitcher of beer there? You want me to have one with you? I don't want to be rude. I mean, I am an elected public official. I'm a man of the people, so don't want to snub anybody, hurt their feelings. I'll drink one, no more than one. Well, maybe I will have another one. Okay, you know. Holy cow, it's 8 o'clock. And you know that part of the book where Bill's pounding on the bar, whiskey rising to his head, saying, how did this happen again? Oh, well, I might as well get good and blasted tonight. How many times did I do that? I'd like to say that it only happened once or twice, but unfortunately, to be truthful, it happened almost every night. I'd go over there, at least until I got out of Hopkins. How did they know they wrote that book? How did they know? Well, Ken and Bob, bless their hearts, they came to my chambers every Friday at noon. They brought a brown bag lunch in their big book. And we sat, the three of us, and we read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they told me then what they thought we had read. And then I told them what I thought we had read. Needless to say, what I thought was significantly different from what they thought. Now, I didn't know. I mean, I just didn't know. And they knew that I didn't know. And they also knew that if I knew that they knew something that I didn't know and that I knew that they knew something I didn't know, I would be angry knowing that they knew something I didn't know that they knew. And so they were very persistent and very consistent in trying to teach me what it was that they knew that I didn't know. Now, eventually, I did come to know what it was that they knew, and by the time I knew what it was that they knew that I didn't know, when I knew it, at that point, then not knowing wasn't such a big deal. So, if you're here tonight and you followed that, you're in the right place. And if you didn't follow it, you're still in the right place. It just means you don't know. It was December 22nd, and it was Friday, and the courthouse was closed because it was the Friday before Christmas. And we couldn't meet in my chamber, so we went out to a restaurant and just had lunch. And after lunch, we parted, and I went back to my apartment. My wife and I were separated yet again. And when I got back to my apartment, there was a package propped against the door of my apartment. I took it into the apartment. Answering machine had a lot of messages on it. My primary girlfriend had a lot of plans for us for Christmas. And I'm trying to open this package and listen to those messages. And I finally see how to cut the tape. And I cut the tape and I lift the lid of that box. And boom! And I got blown back against the wall. And a federal appellate judge in Birmingham, Alabama, had been killed about 2 weeks before that by a bomb that had been sent to him. And not too many days after that, a lawyer in Savannah, Georgia, was killed by a bomb that had been sent to him. And I could smell the gunpowder, and I knew that I'd opened a bomb. There was a fire. I tried to put out the fire. I couldn't. I went out in the hallway and I pulled the fire alarm and my neighbor came. He said he had a fire extinguisher and I went back into my apartment and I went to call 911 on the telephone, and when I went to push the buttons, it was the first I realized that part of my right hand had been blown away. And after talking to the 911 people, I hung up the phone and I could feel, it felt as if somebody were pulling my pants off my hips. And I looked down at the ground, and I was standing in a puddle of blood, and it was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger as I looked at it. And I knew I was in serious trouble. And my neighbor came and asked if there was anything else he could do, and I asked if he would give me a towel. And I opened my pants, and I did not have the courage to attempt to visualize the wound. I just put the towel where I thought the wound was and put my back against the wall, and I slid down onto the floor, and it was real clear to me that I was dying. And I was going to die on that floor. I was never going to see my wife or our children again. And I was going to die on that floor. Now, Ken and Bob had been encouraging me to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I refused to go in Hagerstown because Hagerstown Alcoholics Anonymous was experiencing a tremendous growth spurt under my leadership as judge. Because I knew what to do with alcoholics. I sent them to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's where you belong. So I started to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, which is about 30 miles up Interstate 81, and down in Martinsburg, West Virginia, which is about the same distance south. And went to meetings over in Frederick, Maryland, and I came to those meetings. Always left early. First time, you caught me with the Lord's Prayer, and so after that, I left early. I was frequently there. I try to get there after the Serenity Prayer, but sometimes meetings don't start on time, and so I ended up praying the Serenity Prayer, at least hearing it prayed. And I'm laying on that floor of my apartment dying. And I got nothing. Nothing I can do. Scared to death. Powerless. The only thing I knew to do, the only tool I had, I picked up in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had the Serenity Prayer. And I prayed that God would grant me the serenity to accept this thing which I could not change, and the courage to change the things I could, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer. And I can't tell you whether the sixth, seventh, or eighth time through that prayer, but I can tell you this, it was answered, and God came. And I experienced a peace and a serenity, the likes of which I have never experienced in my life before or since. I did not know if I was going to live or if I was going to die. What I knew was that it was going to be all right. If I died on that floor that Friday before Christmas, never to see my wife or our children again, it would be all right. The policemen and the firemen and the EMTs came bursting into the room, and my eardrums had been blown out, and I couldn't really hear what they were saying, and they were shouting, and I stopped praying and tried to talk to them, and I said, guys, do what you got to do. And I went, this wave of fear swept upon me as soon as I stopped praying that prayer. And man, I've got to get back to that prayer. And so I went back to that prayer, and as soon as I got back to it, serenity returned and the peace and the well-being. Whatever happens here, Jack, it'll be all right. It'll be all right. They cut all my clothes off of me except for my red and green Christmas socks. They put me on a gurney and took me down three flights of steps and out the door of the apartment building, and our little TV station was there with their camera, and my Christmas socks went round the world on CNN. Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw and Peter Jennings all mentioned me that night. But I didn't know anything about it. They took me to the hospital and they prepped me for surgery, and they couldn't find my wife and they couldn't find my girlfriend, but they found Ken, my sponsor. And they allowed him to come back to where I was. I don't know if this is part of the sponsor's handbook or not, but he came and he held my hand. And he just held my hand. And they took me up to surgery, and they removed a piece of shrapnel that was not resting against, but in very close proximity to my femoral artery. And I think we all know, had my femoral artery been nicked, you'd have a different speaker here tonight. And I don't know how shrapnel knows how to stop passing through flesh. I don't know how that happens. I just know it did. And they took me up to the recovery floor, to my recovery room, and I think it maybe was the next day or the day after, and I'm laying there in my bed on my throne of contempt and self-pity. Somebody's tried to kill me. And my sponsor, Bob, was seated at the foot of the bed, and he was smiling. It's good to have a sponsor. Sponsors have a different take on things. They see things differently. I said, Bob, I notice you're smiling. I don't see anything humorous here, but could you explain? Well, Jack, he said, I just think it must be wonderful. Wonderful, Bob. Somebody just tried to kill me. Maybe you'd like to explain further. I just think it must be wonderful to know that you can't be harmed. Like I said, it's good to have a sponsor. I don't understand where you're going with this, Bob. He said, well, Jack, as I understand it, that package that you opened contained four pipe bombs. He says, one pipe bomb is more than sufficient to kill a human being. Two pipe bombs, a little redundant. Three pipe bombs, round the bend. Four pipe bombs, you've made somebody very angry. He said, I think man has done his very best to kill you, and you're here by the grace of God. It's good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that in a million years. Nope. He said, God has work for you, Jack. Really, Bob? What kind of work do you think he has for me? I don't know, Jack. I don't know. He says, what I do know is that God wants you to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that means you're going to have to pray that third step prayer with me or Ken. You're going to have to do that fourth step inventory. You're going to have to do that fifth step with Ken or I. Do the sixth and seventh step. Make that eighth step list. Start making those ninth step amends so you can live in 10, 11, and 12, and you can be of service to God. Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that either. What I had at that time was what I would call cake mix sobriety. And by that I mean if you and I went out of here tonight and went over to that food line or wherever and got a box of Duncan Hines Red Velvet Cake Mix, and if I had it here tonight, I can assure you that on the back of that Duncan Hines box, there is a three-step program for the production of a red velvet cake. Now, I could read that to you. I could give it to you, and you could read it to me. Or we could pass it around the room, and we could all read it out loud to ourselves. And I'm the kind of guy that once we read that box, I'm looking for my cake. All I've done is read a box. Where's my cake? Kind of like me in the big book. I read the big book, I'm looking around for my recovery. Where's my recovery? Cake mix sobriety is what I got. Have to take action on the steps, Jack. You get what you get because you do what you do. If you want something you never had, Jack, you're going to have to do something you've never done. Well, I tell you, I may not be much, but I'm all I think about. Now, Bob knew my anger with God, and he knew that I kind of bristled with antagonism towards the mention of God in these steps. And he said, Jack, how old were you when you prayed that prayer that your dad would stop drinking? So I was 14. He said, how old were you when your dad stopped drinking? 26. He said, do you know what 12 years means to infinite God? Hadn't considered that. He said, 12 years to infinite God is a nanosecond. It's nothing. It's an infinitesimal period of time. I would say, Jack, that you got pretty good service. Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that either. So I began taking the steps, and I began reading the book and trying to really find out what was in the book and not just read it. And I was encouraged. You know, it says in chapter 2 that alcohol is but a symptom, that my problem is not drinking. My problem is learning to live successfully not drinking. We got that chapter more about alcoholism. My favorite guy in the whole book is the Jaywalker. I love the Jaywalker. That guy, what a guy, man. He just sticks, hangs in there, buddy. Going out between parked cars, out in front of fire engines. Don't you get charged up when you hear about that? Man, that gets my adrenaline going. I love the Jaywalker. What a guy. It says in that second chapter, the problem for the alcoholic centers in the mind. I don't know about what you do in your mind, but all I do in my mind is think. Simply how I think is my problem. S-H-I-T. Simply how I think. I am not good at it. We got a pamphlet. We publish a pamphlet on his AA for you, and with just a couple editorial changes. Here are some of the questions. Have you ever decided to stop thinking for a week or so, but only lasted for a couple days? Do you wish people would mind their own business about your thinking and stop telling you what to do? Do you envy people who can think without getting into trouble? Have you had problems connected with thinking during the past year? Has your thinking caused trouble at home? Do you tell yourself that you can stop thinking anytime you want to? Even though you keep thinking when you don't mean to? Have you missed days of work or school because of your thinking? Have you ever felt that your life would be better if you just did not think? Simply how I think is my problem. I am not good at it. Not good at it. I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous what I thought could be taken care of by a matter of willpower, just a better code of morals, a better philosophy of living, not drinking and not changing. I'm sure I can do this better. I know I really did suffer from the delusion that I could wrest happiness out of life if I just managed better. But you see, I was using a broken piece of equipment, and I didn't know it. When I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I find out I suffer from a spiritual illness, and the answer to my illness is a spiritual solution, a vital spiritual experience, and I don't know how to acquire that. I don't know how to acquire that. And by taking the steps of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous with my sponsors, I came to believe and understand that I come here as a human being seeking a spiritual experience, only to discover that I am in fact a spiritual being and I'm having a human experience. I didn't come down here from Hagerstown to tell you lies. I came down here to tell you about some things that I've learned. I've learned that I have to walk by faith. Me, I prefer walking by sight. Show me. Maybe I'll do it. But my sponsor said, Jack, you just have to step out in faith. You got to do stuff you've never done based on our representation to you that it will work for you. I was encouraged in the big book where it says many of us didn't want to do this. I haven't met anybody yet who wanted to do it. For those of you who are here tonight with got, 6 months or less of sobriety in AA, we know a lot about you, as Beth said the other night. And for sure, it's been a lousy year. You're an AA, buddy. This is the best you can do. Your best thinking got you here. You better stay here. You go out there, you're likely to die. You see, I was looking for door number 3. Let's see. Live my life as best I can, blocking out the bitter experiences of my daily living, the pain and suffering of best I can, or learn to live by spiritual experiences. Don't like either. Don't like it. Door number 3, that's for me. Easier, softer way. Stamp that on my... That's what I want. No, no, Jack. No, no. Some people go through life wondering if God exists. And you and I get to go through life on a daily basis watching God work. I don't know a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really don't. The longer I'm here, the less I know. But I know this. I know I am here tonight, standing before you, because somebody prayed. Maybe more than one somebody prayed. I'm pretty sure my wife prayed. I know she prayed. Pretty sure my kids prayed. I think my mother just thought I was crazy. She knows I'm not alcoholic, but I'm pretty sure she prayed. Somebody help my son. I also know that those of you who are here tonight who are alcoholic like I'm alcoholic, you're here because somebody prayed. I don't know who it was. Maybe more than one somebody prayed. I know this. I know that this group of people assembled here this evening has never been assembled in the history of the world. And I know that we will never be assembled again together again. Never. And our book says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find Him now. Right here. Right now. Coming to the Georgia prepaid convention was not my idea. I did not sign up for this. I did not sign up to be a seeker of God, yet it says in the ABCs that God would, could and would if He were sought. Unbeknownst to me, I became a seeker of God. And now, having taken the action on the first 9 steps and have begun living in 10, 11, and 12, I have experienced God. And having experienced God, nothing else will do. Somebody's here tonight. I don't know who you are. You probably wonder what you're doing here. Hadn't planned on attending. Probably thought, I don't think I'm going to go down there tonight. I was there last night. I'm not going back tonight. But yet you're here. I don't know. You're here to hear something. I don't know if it's something I've had to say or not. Maybe you're just here to hear something I have to say, to take it back to your home group, to repeat it out loud so that somebody who's supposed to hear it will hear it. I love it when God does a bank shot. I love it. 18 years ago, I sentenced a guy to 3 years in prison for his third drunk driving. I fished him out of the holding cell at the end of the day, reduced all but 30 days of his sentence, sentenced him to AA for 5 years. 2 years ago, when he got married, he called me and asked me to be his best man. Our book says, great events will come to pass for you and countless others. That was a great event. And we've heard, beginning on Thursday night and all through yesterday and today, of great events that have come to pass for our speakers and for countless others. And it can happen to you. I know some of you it's already happened to. But for those of you who are skeptical and wondering about whether you belong here or not, trust me on this, nobody gets in here by mistake. People who don't have a drinking problem don't sit around wondering if they have a drinking problem. It just doesn't come up. This pamphlet is called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's the greatest piece of literature that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous after the Big Book. I want to read to you something at the conclusion. Tomorrow, in the churches of many of us, there will be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew, which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod, and hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, "Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another?" And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, "Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, the poor have the gospel preached to them." Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit. Those who burn with an inner hunger and an inner thirst, and that the word gospel meant quite literally the good news. A number of years ago, two men, Ken and Bob, working singularly and together, maneuvered me into Alcoholics Anonymous. Tonight, if they were here and they were to say to me, "Tell us, Jack, what did you find?" I would have to say to them that which I say to you now. I can tell you only what I have heard and seen. It seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear and the dead rise. And over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may always be so. My name is Jack. I am an alcoholic. Thank you for letting me share.